Hello, my name is John Eastman. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, which I chair, is hosting a panel discussion on judicial activism. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers, and we have a terrific lineup of speakers for you today. First up will be Dean Erwin Chemerinsky. He is the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, where he also holds a joint appointment in political science. Second up will be Randy E. Barnett, who is the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Legal Theory at the Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches constitutional law and contracts. Third will be Pamela S. Carlin. She's the Kenneth and Harl Montgomery Professor of Public Interest Law and co-director of Stanford Supreme Court Litigation Clinic. And then finally, M. Edward Whalen III, who is the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He directs that organization's program on the Constitution, the courts, and the culture. Welcome, everybody, and let's begin with Dean Chemerinsky.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored to be a part of this discussion and part of this distinguished panel. I think that the concept of judicial activism is remarkably unhelpful in talking about constitutional law in the Supreme Court. I've always thought that judicial activism is just a label that people use for the decisions that they don't like. I think the lack of any utility to the concept of judicial activism is illustrated by two Supreme Court decisions that came down the same week at the end of June 2003. On Monday of that week, the Supreme Court decided Grutter versus Bollinger, and the Supreme Court 5-4 upheld the University of Michigan Law School's affirmative action program. The five in the majority were the more liberal justices, Justice O'Connor, being joined by Justices Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. Justice O'Connor's opinion, though using strict scrutiny because of racial classification, also talked about the need for deference to educational institutions. The four conservative justices, it was then Rehnquist, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, would have struck down what the University of Michigan was doing, would have declared it unconstitutional. Now, on Thursday of that week, the Supreme Court decided Lawrence versus Texas. Lawrence versus Texas involved the Supreme Court declaring unconstitutional a Texas law that prohibited private consensual homosexual activity. Justice Kennedy, writing for the court, in his opinion was joined by Justices Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, found that the right to privacy under the Liberty of the Due Process Clause includes the right of consenting adults to engage in private consensual sexual behavior. There, it was the liberal justices who wanted to strike down the law, and it was the conservative justices who said there was a need to defer to the legislature. What's so interesting here is that in one case, it was the conservatives who wanted to strike down the legislature, in the other, it was the liberals who wanted to strike down the legislature. In one case, it was the conservatives who wanted to follow precedent, in the other, it was the liberals who wanted to follow precedent. In one case, it was a situation where you had the conservatives who were urging the need to follow popular will, and the other, it was the liberals. Neither of these decisions can be explained by the text of the Constitution. The Equal Protection Clause doesn't tell us whether the University of Michigan can engage in affirmative action, nor does the text of the Constitution tell us whether liberty should include a right to engage in private consensual homosexual behavior. And neither can be justified in terms of framers' intent. I think if there's any place where framers' intent is clear, it's that those who drafted the 14th Amendment meant to allow things that we think of as affirmative action today. My point in using these cases is that liberals and conservatives both want to be activists at times. They just disagree where activism should occur. Let me suggest several reasons why the language of judicial activism isn't at all helpful. First, it confuses a descriptive statement with a normative assessment. Judicial activism is ultimately descriptive, is the court being activist or restrained, but it has gotten, because of its use, a normative context of to say something is activist is to criticize it. The reality is, activism can be good or activism can be bad. Marbury versus Madison was an activist decision. The Supreme Court was creating a power for the judiciary that's nowhere mentioned in the text of the Constitution. It's unclear whether the framers intended it, but I think we'd all agree that Marbury versus Madison was desirable. Brown versus Board of Education was, depending on how you define it, an activist decision. The Supreme Court was overturning a 96-year-old precedent, a 56, 58-year-old precedent the Supreme Court was striking down laws that existed in every southern state. I think this court was ignoring the framers' intent. I think the strong argument that those who drafted the 14th Amendment also voted to segregate the District of Columbia public schools. And so I think it's unhelpful because you're confusing descriptive and normative. Second, I think it's unhelpful because it's so ambiguous. There's never been a clear definition of what's meant by activism versus restraint. Now, just as I've been using it, I've tried to pick up what conservatives often said, that a court is being more activist if it's overturning laws, more restrained if it's upholding laws. It's being more activist if it's overturning precedent, more restrained if it's following precedent. It's more active if it rules broadly, more restrained if it rules narrowly. More active if they're following the text, the framers' intent, more active if they're ignoring it. But if you think about the Supreme Court's decision from January in Citizens United, there the court was overturning a law adopted by Congress. They were overturning two precedents, including a recent one. They ruled very broadly when narrow rulings would have been available. They found a right of corporations to spend money under the First Amendment, even though the First Amendment doesn't say that. And I think it's quite questionable that the framers ever intended to protect corporations, which again shows that what's active and what's restrained is just a label. It's a conclusion. It's not very helpful in analysis. The third and final point that I would make is that I think that talking about activism and restraint obscures the important questions of constitutional law. When you're talking about individual rights, there are always four questions. One is there a fundamental right? And we need to talk about how are we going to decide what are fundamental rights under the Constitution. We can argue about originalism, non-originalism, and other methods of determining that, but activism and restraint don't help us. A second question is there an infringement of the right? How do we determine when the government is infringing the right? There are talk about direct and substantial burdens or unconstitutional conditions, but activism and restraint aren't helpful. Third, is there a sufficient justification for the government's action? If it's strict scrutiny, is there a compelling interest, a rational basis, or a legitimate interest? Activism and restraint can't answer those questions. And the fourth and final issue often is, are the means used by the government sufficiently related to the end? If it's strict scrutiny, is this the least restrictive alternative? Activism and restraint don't help us there. The bottom line is that the court inevitably has a great deal of discretion in interpreting the Constitution. What we should be talking about is how should the court use that discretion? The labels of activism and restraint just aren't helpful.
Thank you, Dean Chemerinsky. Next, we have Professor Randy Barnett from Georgetown Law Center.
Well, thanks again for inviting me to be part of this distinguished group. I find myself in a somewhat awkward position of agreeing almost 100% with what Erwin Chemerinsky just said about the use of judicial activism. And he said some of the things that I would have said, and so I'm going to actually shift the focus a little bit to the historical origins of the accusation that courts are engaged in judicial activism, and hopefully as a way of inducing or enticing those who are politically conservative or libertarian to abandon this way of talking, although at the end of my remarks I'm going to provide a definition of activism for those judicial activism and judicial restraint for those who still want to use that terminology, since that terminology has some political bite. The term judicial activism was originally invented by political progressives as a way of criticizing the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court was striking down progressive legislation, either federal or state. They were using the Commerce Clause and the Due Process Clause to strike down federal legislation, and they were using the Due Process Clause to strike down of the 14th Amendment to strike down state legislation. And in response to this, political progressives made a number of criticisms, some of which are grounded on originalism, but some of them were grounded, in other words, they were arguing that these decisions violated the original meaning of the Constitution, as exemplified by some broad readings of the Marshall Court opinions. But the other accusation they made went to judicial role or judicial propriety, and they criticized the court for thwarting the will of the Democratic majorities as expressed by popularly elected and accountable legislatures. If that sounds familiar, it should. It's the same criticism the conservatives made later on against, for example, the Warren Court, when the Warren Court protected, for example, criminal rights of defendants in criminal proceedings. How the term judicial activism and the opposite judicial restraint came to flip political ideologies is quite interesting, and I think somewhat unknown. My impression is that the New Deal justices who were eventually appointed by Frederick Roosevelt agreed about one thing and one thing only, and that is that they agreed that they should uphold the New Deal legislation. They didn't really agree about why or how, and in fact they were somewhat divided amongst themselves between those who accepted the progressive critique of judicial activism and thought that judicial restraint was the norm across the board, and those who were more influenced by the originalist critique of the progressive era Supreme Court, and thought that the important thing was for the court to get it right. And then there were, of course, those who were neither originalist nor restraint and just thought that the court should get it right. So the court was not in a complete agreement. And eventually what happened, was when the court started confronting constitutional problems that were not involving the New Deal, including problems of racial segregation as well as problems involving criminal procedure, and eventually problems arising surrounding right of privacy in the case of Griswold versus Connecticut involving contraceptives, and then again eventually Roe versus Wade. When the court started confronting all of these things, their sort of pro-New Deal posture did them no good, and they divided up into a number of camps, competing camps, some advocating judicial restraint and some not advocating judicial restraint. And eventually, when political conservatives started to gain a head of steam in the 1970s and 1980s, they essentially adopted, or at least many of them adopted, the judicial conservative position that the problem with the Warren Court was that it was activist and unduly interfering both with the popularly elected branches as well as the operation of the executive branches. I think that this is a dead end for political conservatives and libertarians for many of the reasons that Irwin already explained. Unless one opposes judicial review entirely, that is, the act of striking down legislation entirely, the key question isn't whether a court is striking down or upholding. The key question is whether the court is justified in striking down or upholding legislation. And that's something that has to be debated, and that has to be debated on the merits. Conservatives, at the same time they were pursuing a judicial philosophy of judicial restraint, were also at the same time pursuing what I think is a correct approach to interpreting the Constitution according to its original public meaning. But if you're going to protect the Constitution or uphold the Constitution and enforce it and interpret it according to its original meaning, this means striking down legislation that violates the text of the Constitution as properly interpreted. So the debate that really ought to take place between those who support a particular law and those who oppose a particular law on constitutional grounds is the law constitutional according to a proper interpretation of the Constitution, and then we can debate what a proper interpretation of the Constitution is, or is it constitutional or is it unconstitutional? And that's what we should be debating, not whether courts are acting in an activist manner when they thwart the popular will, which is something that they are in the business of doing, if a popularly elected legislature, for whatever reason, has chosen to violate the Constitution. So I would urge us to shift our focus from the judicial sin of activism or restraint to the constitutional sin of violating or respecting the Constitution of the United States. However, for those who want to persist in using the term judicial activism, because in fact it does have a strong political valence, I would urge the following definition, and that is, it is an activist decision for courts to either strike down a law that is actually constitutional or uphold a law that is unconstitutional, that it is activist for courts to put their own views of the merits of a law above or beyond the appropriate interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. And it is a restrained, and it is an example of judicial restraint when courts are willing to enforce the Constitution, whether that means upholding or striking down a law, even when doing so runs against their own political preferences or their own political objectives. So for those reasons, I would say judicial activism is ignoring the Constitution, whether to uphold or strike down a law, and judicial restraint is respecting the Constitution, even when doing so is something that would rub up against one's political preferences.
Very good. Next, we have Pamela Carlin, professor at Stanford Law School.
Well, I, too, want to thank the Federalist Society for setting up the call and say how much I enjoy listening to the other folks that are panelists today. In a sense, there's a problem here because, of course, I'm going to agree in substantial part with both Irwin and Randy. You know, there's this famous example that Bertrand Russell once gave of how to conjugate an irregular verb. And the example he gave was, I am firm, you are obstinate, he is a pig-headed fool. And his point is pretty obvious. Three words with roughly the same denotation can have very different connotations based on people's perspective. So perspective matters. And I think the same is true for critiques of constitutional interpretation. If Bertrand Russell were giving his example here, it would be, I am principled, you are result-oriented, and he is a judicial activist. So like Irwin, to an extent like Randy, I think the phrase judicial activism has essentially become a synonym for judicial decisions or judicial approaches I don't like. Last summer, for example, we were treated, and I use the word advisedly here, to charges that Sonia Sotomayor might be a judicial activist because of her decision in the Ricci against DiStefano case when she was on the Court of Appeals. That was a case, as you'll remember, that involved whether New Haven had violated the rights of white firefighters by setting aside a promotional test. So what did it mean for her to allow the city of New Haven to do this and to be charged with judicial activism? I mean, her decision, after all, was to allow the people of New Haven, through their elected representatives, to make choices. You might disagree or agree with those choices, and I think this is Randy's point, but it's hard to say that that's activist or not. So in the same spirit, I think, that Randy had, I thought I would talk about three forms of judicial intervention, because I think we can talk about whether courts intervene or not to overturn other branches' decisions. And it seemed to me there might be three forms of judicial intervention that are both important and normatively attractive and worth talking about. The first of these is what we might call the Thayerian response, in kind of honor of James Bradley Thayer's famous 1893 article on the origin and scope of the American doctrine of constitutional law, where he talks about judicial review and when courts ought to intervene. And towards the very end of the article, he makes the following point, which I think is even truer today than it was in his time, which is he writes, "No doubt our doctrine of constitutional law has had a tendency to drive out questions of justice and right, and to fill the mind of legislators with thoughts of mere legality, of what the Constitution allows. And moreover, even in the matter of legality, they have felt little responsibility. If they are wrong, they say, the courts will correct it." He was right at the time, and it became even more correct as an observation during the 20th and now the 21st centuries. Legislators pass laws, or in California they endorse initiatives, that they know to be unconstitutional, and they leave the courts to clean up the mess. A particularly telling recent example of this is how Senator Arlen Specter voted for the Military Commissions Act in Congress and then filed an amicus brief at the Supreme Court urging the court to strike it down. Courts can't fulfill their oaths here and avoid what we might call activism or intervention. To paraphrase Barry Goldwater's acceptance speech at the 1964 Republican Convention, intervention in the defense of constitutional values is no vice, and restraint in the face of unconstitutional conduct is no virtue. So there's a set of cases where it's absolutely clear that what the legislature has done is to violate the Constitution, and judges have to step in then. The second form of intervention that I think it's worth talking about and defending is what I call the federalist in the kind of original meaning of the term response, which is federalism as a kind of form of nationalism in the United States in the Marshallian sense. And this is where courts step in to enforce national constitutional norms on outliers. It involves almost entirely striking down state rather than federal statutes. And just to give three examples of this, Brown against Board of Education, I think, is an example. The court stepped in to enforce an understanding of the Equal Protection Clause that had national approval. as seen by the fact that the federal government participated in the case on the side of the school children. But there was a regional outlier there. By the time the Supreme Court stepped in to require the appointment of counsel in criminal cases in Gideon against Wainwright, the vast majority of states were already doing it. And by the time the Supreme Court stepped in Lawrence against Texas, the case that Irwin mentioned earlier, there were virtually only a handful of states that still prohibited private consensual sexual activity by adults. And so this is a case in which constitutional values have already been instantiated in much of the country, and there are outlier regions that have to be brought into line. And the third form of intervention that I think is actually quite important is what's often referred to as the Elysian response, or in honor of John Hardeeley, and that's process failure cases. The most activist decision by the Supreme Court in my lifetime, I think, in the sense of the most interventionist, the most overturning of precedent, the least originalist, and the one with the widest consequences, was the series of cases that have come to be known as the reapportionment revolution and one person, one vote. Yet I think there's no set of decisions by the Supreme Court that are more popular or that have more gained traction within the American people. And today we see that same kind of argument being made both by liberals and conservatives, by conservatives in the campaign finance cases where they say you have to step in to prevent legislators from entrenching themselves, and by liberals who argue that we need to solve the problem of political gerrymandering. So I don't think it's possible really to talk about judicial activism without recognizing that it's an intervention and that there are many situations in which courts have to intervene. And so I guess I end up in the same position as Randy, saying that we really need to discuss which values require courts to overturn the political processes rather than whether there are values that require their intervention.
Thank you, Professor Carlin. Next is Ed Whalen at the Ethics and Public Policy Center.
Well, thank you, John. I'm pleased to be on this panel with such distinguished scholars. I will offer a defense of the term judicial activism. I hope you'll see that my defense involves agreement with several of the points that others have made, but also disagreement on some key points. Let me begin with the observation that I think the relevant question is not whether the term judicial activism is often used poorly. Clearly, that's just the case. It's also the case with lots of other terms that no one seeks to banish from public discourse. Basic terms like conservative, liberal, moderate are fuzzy, are used in contradictory ways, yet there's no sense that that these are terms that can't be used well. So the relevant question, I think, is whether the term judicial activism is capable of being used well, and I'd submit that the answer to that question is plainly yes, and that indeed the term judicial activism is the best term to capture succinctly the wrongful judicial invasion of the realm of representative government. Now let me elaborate what I mean by the term as I use it. The core of judicial activism consists of the wrongful overriding by judges of democratic enactments or other policy choices made by other government officials, most typically through the invention of new constitutional rights, with Roe versus Wade being the classic modern example. It captures a distinct category of judicial error when used this way. It certainly isn't it's not a catch-all term for all judicial error. It captures the type of error where judges overstep their bounds, and the term properly signals the limits on the role of the courts in our system of separation of powers and representative government. And the opposite term, judicial restraint, obviously captures courts staying within their proper domain. Now, there's an alternative definition that is, I think, a plausible one that's often used, and I think Randy referred to it. It involves a judge indulging his own policy preferences, whether he's upholding or striking down legislation. I just favor this definition for two reasons. First, it requires a sort of psychologizing or imputation of motive to a judge. And second, it seems to me weird to call instances where a judge wrongly lets democratic enactments operate. It seems strange to use the term activism to describe that. I prefer the term judicial passivism for that category of error. Now, I often hear, and indeed I think a couple of folks have made this observation on this call, that the term judicial activism doesn't perform any analytical work, and that whether or not a ruling is activist depends entirely on the underlying theory of sound constitutional judging. I think that objection is correct, but I don't think it defeats the arguments for the use of the term. No term performs analytical work. Propositions do. And again, the term judicial activism has descriptive value in succinctly capturing the court's wrongful invasion of the realm of representative government and the injury that that invasion inflicts on the powers of American citizens. And the term itself, rather than leading to a dead end, ought to trigger a deeper discussion of what method of constitutional interpretation is proper. Relatedly, I note that those who think that there is no right way to interpret the Constitution can't complain about judicial activism, or at least have no intelligible way of using the term, since they're unable to say that a particular ruling is wrong. Let me address a couple other objections to the term, as well as some alternative definitions. Some folks use the term judicial activism to mean simply not adhering to precedent. But if the precedent itself is activist, then it's nothing inconsistent with principles of judicial restraint to overturn that precedent and to remove, to undo the judicial invasion of the realm of representative government. Sometimes it's proposed, and I believe Dean Chemerinsky suggested this, that the term could be used to refer to any invalidation of a statute or regulation, irrespective of whether it's right or wrong, so-called neutral definition of the term. I think that is not a helpful definition, but and I'm reminded in particular of William F. Buckley's response to the leftist charge during the Cold War that the CIA and the KGB were engaged in morally equivalent acts of spycraft. As Buckley put it, that's like saying that the man who pushes an old lady into the path of a hurtling bus is not to be distinguished from the man who pushes an old lady out of the path of a hurtling bus on the grounds that, after all, in both cases, someone is pushing old ladies around. Likewise, I'd say here, to simply observe that in different cases the court is striking down legislation obscures the important question of whether it's doing so rightly or wrongly. Now, I think the term has come under attack precisely because it's acquired its stigma the old-fashioned way. It's earned it. It's earned it through a whole series of liberal judicial activist opinions that entrench the left's agenda on abortion, the death penalty, pornography, secularism, etc. I have a different understanding of the history of the term. According to one account, the first recorded use was by Arthur Schlesinger in the 1940s, and it was largely descriptive on his part, but again, in succeeding decades, the term acquired the stigma that it has. Now, of course, there are also charges of conservative judicial activism, and those charges deserve to be taken seriously. The temptation to indulge one's own policy preferences is a human impulse, not a conservative or a liberal one. Conservatives have developed principles of judging designed to guard against such indulgence, and it's perfectly proper, obviously, to call into question how well those principles have worked and how well they've been followed. But it, you know, by contrast, I think the liberal approach to the living constitution involves principles that are designed to justify that indulgence. So, bottom line, I think the term has value and significance, both politically but also descriptively, in identifying a very important category of judicial error.
Thank you, Ed. Well, we're at the end of our first round here. It seems that the one thing we all agree on is the term judicial activism can't be as simplistically described as just simply striking down legislation that creates problems of its own. Let's now go back through and let everybody else have another minute or two to respond to any of the other things that have been said. Dean Chemerinsky.
Thank you. It's been fascinating to hear everybody's position. I still believe that we should get rid of the label judicial activism. I still think, as I said and as Pam said, it's just a label people use for the decisions that they don't like. Now, I was arguing that earlier based on, I think it confuses descriptive and normative concepts, that there's no clear definition, and that it really obscures what should be the important discussion on issues in constitutional law. The responses given by Ed and in part by Randy are to try to come up with a definition of judicial activism, and I want to respond to that. Ed's definition is that judicial activism is the wrongful invasion of the prerogatives of representative government. But the question is, how do we decide what's wrongful? How do we know whether Marbury versus Madison, which struck down a part of the Judiciary Act of 1789, was wrongful? How do we know if Brown versus Board of Education was wrongful in striking down what state legislatures were doing? How do we know if District of Columbia versus Heller in striking down a D.C. gun ordinance was wrongful? Or Citizens United with regard to campaign finance? We have to have an underlying theory. Judicial activism doesn't give us that. And in fact, I think it keeps us from developing that by having a simplistic slogan. Now, I strongly disagree with Ed that the court's being activist if it's protecting non-textual rights. In fact, if you look for the last century, the court has protected such non-textual rights as the right to marry, the right to procreate, the right to custody of children, the right to keep the family together, the right to control upbringing of children, the right to purchase and use contraceptives, the right to abortion, the right to private consensual and sexual activity, the right to refuse medical care. They found freedom of association, the Dormant Commerce Clause. We can go on and on with the long list of rights. So I don't think judicial activism tells all of that is wrong. Randy's definition is that activism is the judge is following his or her own policy preferences. But no judge believes he or she is just following his or her own policy preference. Every judge believes that he or she is interpreting the Constitution. What we should really be talking about is the substance of the meaning of the Constitution and get rid of the label judicial activism.
Professor Barnett.
Yes, I'd like to take Ed's suggestion as a friendly amendment. That is, I like the term judicial passivism. I've heard it. I've even used it. Judicial passivism is the wrongful refusal to strike down a law that is unconstitutional, as opposed to judicial activism, which is the wrongful striking down of a law that is actually constitutional. But beyond that, I still think there's a problem with using judicial activism because it essentially has the function of undercutting legitimacy of judicial intervention, really when intervention is entirely appropriate. I mean, Ed has built into his definition appropriate, but in fact, the sin of judicial activism is the sin of intervention, intervening in the democratic, the more democratic representative branches, and it's that sin that undercuts the legitimacy of courts intervening even when they ought to. I want to spend a minute now to point out another problem that the notion of judicial restraint, which is the opposite of judicial activism, creates. It's one that is really under-noticed by constitutional scholars, one I intend to write about in the future, so I want to stake my claim to this territory right now, and that is the problem of double deference. The problem of double deference is the problem of judges exercising a kind of Thayerian restraint, saying that they want to defer to the legislature's assessment of the constitutionality of what it is doing in the interest of respecting a co-equal branch of government. And so they defer to the legislature's assessment of its own constitutionality. And then the legislature, in assessing the constitutionality of what it's doing, says it does so on the grounds of predicting whether the Supreme Court will or will not uphold what it enacts under its previous decisions. So you essentially have courts deferring to the legislative judgment of constitutionality. Then you have legislatures deferring, in assessing constitutionality, deferring to the court's assessment of constitutionality, but yet the court's precedent involving constitutionality is itself a deference to the legislature. What's lost in this problem, in this phenomenon of double deference or finger-pointing, where each side is pointing to the other institution to protect the Constitution, what's lost in this double deference problem is the Constitution itself. When the courts defer to the legislature, the courts are not independently examining the constitutionality of what the legislature has done. And when the legislature makes its own assessment of constitutionality based on what it predicts courts will rule, it is not making its own independent assessment of the constitutionality of what it's doing. And therefore, the constitutionality never enters into this equation unless it's the president who decides to inject his or her opinion in vetoing a law. So, and this is all brought about by this underlying philosophy of judicial restraint, which is courts should be deferring to congressional assessments of its own constitutionality. It actually has a pretty ancient vintage in this country, but that doesn't make it right. And as a result, I think the Constitution is what gets lost, and I think that's a pretty high cost to pay, a pretty high price to pay.
Professor Carlin?
Yeah, I think that we're kind of coalescing on an understanding that there are two types of errors courts might make, you know, and people refer to these in other areas of social science and like as type A and type B errors or false positives and false negatives. And they both go to the question of when should courts defer to what other branches have decided and when should they stay out of what other branches have decided. And I don't think the word activism by itself captures what we're really concerned about, because even Ed, who's giving I think the most robust defense of the four of us on the panel of what activism means, has to use words like justified or wrongful to describe the interventions he wants to condemn. And the problem with judicial activism itself as a phrase is it seems to contain the word wrongful, but I think among the four of us on the call, we would all disagree on which interventions in recent years by the Supreme Court have been appropriate and which ones not. That is, there is no justice that anyone can point to who is a complete pacifist in that sense or completely restrained. I think the thing that would surprise conservatives is that the justice now on the Supreme Court of the justices who's been there more than a year or two, who votes to strike down laws the least often is Justice Breyer, and not one of the more conservative justices, even though today judicial activism is largely a charge bandied about by conservatives and not by liberals. And that's because the decisions of judges to intervene are going to be, I think, in large part a reaction to the kinds of statutes that come in front of them, and not just to something about their own philosophy. That is, the kinds of statutes that lead to constitutional challenges and the kinds of statutes in which legislatures are at some particular point overreaching themselves. So I'm somewhat skeptical that we can dust off the phrase judicial activism except to turn it into a phrase that each side uses as a way of attacking the decisions it doesn't like.
And Mr. Whalen.
Well, a few comments. First, just to be clear, I agree with Erwin and Pam that my definition of the term requires, in turn, a development of a constitutional theory in order to explain what is a right decision and what is a wrong one when the court strikes down a statute. I hope I made that clear before. So I absolutely agree that the term judicial activism itself doesn't convey or even imply what that constitutional theory is. My own judgment beyond the scope of the conversation here is that original meaning supplemented by principles of judicial restraint provides the proper method of constitutional interpretation. Again, I want to say that we have so many terms in our political discourse that are inexact, that can be used in conflicting ways, that sometimes are used in a way that's unhelpful. And clearly that's the case, and we see it in this conversation itself where people are using the term in different ways. Clearly that's the case with the term judicial activism. I would say that is reason to work towards agreement on a proper use of the term, or at least to clarify what one means when one uses it, not a reason to abandon the term. Because I want to emphasize, and with all respect, this is the point I think that professors of constitutional law might pay less attention to than others. But you know, at bottom, we have a system of representative government in which American citizens are responsible for forming policy on a broad bulk of issues. If that system is going to work properly, citizens need to take their responsibilities seriously. They need to know that when the court has acted wrongfully, it's up to them to try to get that corrected. Now, some folks may be content to live in a system where we basically a system of government by judiciary, where we have the Supreme Court sitting on top, deciding under one theory or another that this political enactment oversteps some bounds not discernible in the Constitution. That's not our system. In my judgment, it's not a system that American citizens should acquiesce in, and I think that the term judicial activism is important precisely because of its political potency in reminding folks that the judicial realm is a limited one, and when the courts step beyond those bounds, they act unconstitutionally.
Very good. Let me begin the next round with a question that tries to drill down to the heart of what I hear is the area of disagreement. I think we would all agree that if Congress were to pass a law authorizing someone to be president of the United States at age 30 instead of age 35 as the Constitution requires, that that law would be unconstitutional and it would be appropriate, not judicially active, for the court to strike that down. The difficulty comes, of course, when you have when you're dealing with constitutional clauses that are not quite so black and white, the amorphous clauses. And some years ago, I published an article called "Judicial Review of Unenumerated Rights: Does Marbury's Holding Apply in a Post-Warren Court World?" that tries to get at the heart of that question. Due process or the Ninth Amendment rights, unenumerated rights more broadly. If we don't have a consistent constitutional theory that allows for us to accurately describe what those rights are and that the court then can use those rights it finds to strike down legislation, isn't that the heart of whether we're on one side or the other of the judicial active question? Let me open that up to any of you in whatever order you want to take that up.
Well, Ed Whalen here, given the silence from others. Look, John, I think it's important not merely that the constitutional approach be consistent, but that it be right. there are plenty of theories that could be developed that would enable the courts to do pretty much whatever they want, and no one could say that they were acting in violation of the overarching principles, precisely because the overarching principles impose no limit at all. So, I think it's essential that the courts, the Supreme Court in particular, work to develop a method of constitutional interpretation that is most defensible. I think Randy and I are in broad agreement as to what that is. So we obviously I think differ as to some of the presumptions that operate where things are unclear. Look, I think that we have a system adopted by a historic exercise of popular sovereignty that creates a system of representative government, and there's a default, strong default presumption that a democratic enactment should be permitted to operate. Randy and I are in, I think, strong disagreement on that point, but I think that's what I see as the default.
Right, and maybe I should be the one to respond. I do think that Ed and I are in broad agreement about how the Constitution should be interpreted. I also think he's right in identifying where we disagree, which has to do with this broad default presumption, which is nowhere stated in the Constitution. And is therefore not a matter of interpretation itself, but it's a matter of whatever you want to call it, judicial role or some extra constitutional principle. Ed grounds that extra constitutional principle, as most people, I think, who believe in it would, in some theory of popular sovereignty. Again, all of that is extra constitutional as well. I think there is a disagreement there. Ed would put the presumption in favor of the legislature, which he characterizes as representing a democratic majoritarian will, and I would put the presumption in favor of the individual against the majority, even if that majority manages to gain control of the democratic process and enact its will into law. Still, the individual ought to have a right to demand a justification for their liberties or rights being restricted. And I think that it falls to a neutral third party to adjudicate whether that is an appropriate use of governmental power or not. And the only neutral third party we have in our current constitutional structure is the judiciary, and they're the ones that were historically charged. The judicial power has historically been recognized as asking or including the question of whether the legislature, when it's restricted the rights or the liberties of the people, the sovereign people, are acting within their appropriate powers. Now, one of the problems, I think, that has developed really since the Warren Court, and that is an extremely, and I'm be interested to hear what Pam and Irwin have to say about this, because they may, I can't predict whether they're going to agree with what I'm about to say or not. There's been an extremely robust theory of rights that have developed. Now, as everyone on this call knows, I'm a very strong proponent of broad protections of rights under the Ninth Amendment, which says the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people, as well as the Privileges or Immunities Clause. So I believe in a broad protection of these rights. But when you view rights in so absolute a term as rights equal essentially trumps, to use Ronald Dworkin's phrase, then in order for government to do anything, you have to recognize very few rights. Because if you were to recognize and protect a broad range of rights, whether enumerated or unenumerated, government would easily be rendered impossible. And that really runs against a lot of what the Constitution does represent, which is an empowerment of government as well as a restraint on governmental power. What that suggests is that something less than the hugely broad Trump conception of rights is what's appropriate, both for enumerated and unenumerated rights. And in fact, we don't really protect the enumerated rights with that kind of robust protection, notwithstanding the view that we might. And essentially what I would suggest and what I have suggested is that when a right is articulated or a liberty is articulated, then the burden is on the government to justify what it's doing as necessary and proper, for example, as a standard that's found in the Constitution. And then it's really the burden is on the government to come forward and explain why what it's doing fits that constitutional standard. And if it can do so, it will be upheld, and if it can't, it won't be. This is not, therefore, the assertion of a right is not an automatic trump on legislative power, but it does put the burden on the government to justify what it's doing, and that it does put the place the responsibility in courts to evaluate the claim of the government. And I think that in operation, given how judges are picked and the political process from which they emerge and what groups of people they're drawn from, judges will largely err on the side of upholding governmental power, I fear, rather than striking down governmental power. Exercise of governmental power, but that, as I say, judges are the judicial branch is the only branch we have to adjudicate these kinds of claim of power. I don't think it's going to be the case that judges are going to go overboard if, in fact, they have to evaluate the reasonableness and arbitrariness of judicial interference with individual rights.
Well, this is Pam Carlin. I guess I largely agree with what Randy just said, and the striking thing to me, of course, is the place where he and Ed differ. And as Randy identifies it, it's really this question of the extent to which you're going to err on the side of the individual rather than on the side of the political process's decision. And so, if I could just point to a recent case where I think this comes forward quite strikingly, it's the Parents Involved case, which is the school desegregation case from Seattle and the companion case from Louisville, where the question of what is activist and what isn't, or where the court should intervene and where it shouldn't, comes down to whether you think that the political processes ought to be making the decision about the extent to which racial integration is an important value in society, and to what extent that ought to place a burden on a particular child who wants to go to a school and is told, actually, you'll have to go to a different school than the one you prefer because we're trying to, accomplish racial desegregation here. So that Randy is absolutely right that the question here is how you balance a number of competing values, each of which can be found in the Constitution. That is, I think racial equality is a value that can be found in the Constitution just as much as liberty is a value that can be found in the Constitution, and how you decide at any particular time both what policies actually serve these goals and how to balance them one against each other is extremely difficult. And using a kind of binary distinction, like it's judicial activism if a court steps in, but it's judicial restraint if they don't, doesn't capture the full difficulty of what we're asking courts to do, and indeed what we ask legislators to do when they vote on a particular bill, because they have to make a judgment, and as Randy says, it ought to be an independent judgment on whether they think the law is constitutional or not.
Well, if I may jump in, I'm sorry, Ed Whalen with a brief response to Pam. If we're talking about balancing values found in the Constitution, what better description is there of a realm where the matter ought to be left to the legislatures to resolve?
So you think that the Supreme Court got it wrong in Parents Involved?
We can go into a more elaborate argument about a particular case. I'll say if we accept arguendo your description of the case, then that conclusion follows.
This is Irwin. What I was going to say is I agree with what Pam said, but find I disagree with Randy more than she did. First, I disagree with Randy's premise that there's been a robust theory of individual rights since the Warren Court. I don't think there's been very much of a robust theory of individual rights or very much in a way of robust protection. In fact, since Roe versus Wade, I can't think of an instance in which the Supreme Court has found a fundamental right other than those that were explicit in the text. Even in Lawrence versus Texas, the Supreme Court didn't use the language of strict scrutiny or the language of fundamental rights. I think the court has continued to cut back on rights, to cut back on First Amendment rights, such as free speech, government employees, such as Garcetti versus Abalas. They dramatically cut back on the rights of free exercise of religion, like Employment Division versus Smith. They continue in many areas to cut back on the rights of criminal defendants. And so I don't share the premise that we've got a robust protection of rights, and that's without even getting to whether there should be rights to things like food, shelter, and medical care in the Constitution. Second, he says that rights are a trump, and I think he overstates what that means. Finding a fundamental right does, or not a fundamental right, tells us how we're going to engage in balancing. There's almost no absolute rights in the Constitution. If it's a fundamental right, it means that the government's going to have to meet strict scrutiny, which puts a lot of the balance against the government. If it's not a fundamental right, if it's just rational basis review, then the weights are arranged on the scale in favor of the government. Randy would articulate this differently in terms of necessary and proper, and Randy and I would disagree over what rights should be protected under the Constitution. But isn't that really what we're talking about? What are the rights that should be deemed fundamental under the Constitution? What are the justifications for infringing them? Ed said that American citizens should generally get to make the choices. Obviously, I believe in the democratic process. But conservatives thought it was okay to overturn the choices of the American citizens. In Pam's example of parents involved, or conservatives wanted to overturn the choices of Michigan and Grutter versus Bollinger. Conservatives wanted to overturn what D.C. did in District of Columbia versus Heller. Conservatives wanted to overturn what Congress did in the area of campaign finance and Citizens United. Conservatives wanted to overturn what the Florida Supreme Court did in Bush versus Gore. And so what we're really talking about is, again, what rights, what justifications. Let's talk about that. Activism doesn't help us in terms of analytical clarity.
This is Randy. I'd like to respond a little bit to Erwin because I think he's misunderstood the point I want to make. We actually are in greater agreement than he thinks. When I said that there's been a notion developed since the Warren Court about rights being Trump, this is actually sort of a conception about rights. I entirely agree with him that rights have not been all that robustly protected, and I think that's precisely been because of an overinflated view of what protecting a right means. And even though I also agree with him that, in fact, with respect to enumerated rights, we haven't really treated rights as trumps. That's not exactly what our practice has been. But with the notion that that recognizing an unenumerated right or a right of a parent to raise her child as she sees fit, the right that was recognized by the court in Troxell versus Granville, a case, by the way, in which Justice Thomas was in the majority in that case, with Justice Scalia dissenting, the issue is what is the consequence or what follows from protecting a right? If you, as an observer of the court or a critic of a court or even a justice yourself, think that what follows from protecting a right is this insuperable barrier so that strict scrutiny in theory is actually fatal in fact, which was another view that was held for some time. It's not necessarily true, but that's a view. If that's your view, you are then, what it seems therefore incumbent upon you, so as not to interfere unduly with the democratic branches of government, it's incumbent upon you to recognize as few rights as you can get away with, because to recognize more rights is to essentially hogtie government completely. So it is this ideology of, or this conception of rights as Trump that limits the protection of rights. And that's the reason why I was proposing or suggesting that we need to have a more realistic view of what protecting a right means, and then it's not so threatening to protect more of them. And so apart from that, I think I agree with most of what Erwin said. That is, I don't think since the Warren Court, unenumerated rights have been widely well protected. I also don't think enumerated rights like freedom of speech have been all that well protected. And today we witness a criticism of the court for protecting, and in fact, I think some members of this panel today were, or at least I think it might have been Erwin who criticized the court, for protecting the rights of citizens operating through corporations to express their views in a political context in which their interests are going to be affected, and express their views by making independent expenditures for campaign advertising. That's a right that was upheld, and I'm glad that it was upheld, and yet it's come under heavy criticism by many of my colleagues for having been what they call judicial activism. So Even where rights are being protected, I think they're criticized for having been protected, and I think they should be. So other than that disagreement between Irwin and me, I think we largely agree.
Ed Whalen here with a brief follow-up. Let me just highlight again why I think it's useful to use the term judicial activism to identify this distinct category of error, one that's distinct from judicial passivism, one that's distinct from just messing up. Or, I mean, there are any number of categories of errors, I think, including on you know, misreading statutes. Contrast, say, Roe versus Wade with Kelo in terms of their effect on the powers of the people to work through the system of representative government. Now, I'm not my point here isn't to say that an error of judicial activism is in all respects more offensive than an error of judicial passivism. Obviously, those folks who are victims of errors of judicial passivism have plenty of reason to be aggrieved. The point remains that where you have an error of judicial passivism, a failure to enforce rights, the political branches, the state legislatures, are still empowered to afford those protections. Where, by contrast, you have the wrongful invention of a constitutional right, it is incredibly difficult to undo that. And Roe itself has disrupted our national politics for nearly four decades, in a way that I think lots of folks across the political spectrum would recognize has been damaging. So again, I think that Irwin seems to want to move to just talking about whether a decision is right or wrong, and obviously I'm interested in that, but I think that the category of judicial activism captures something important that makes that category distinct from other categories of error.
And this is John Eastman. Let me pick up on a comment that Randy made, noting the disagreement between Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas in the Troxell case, and this disagreement about the meaning of unenumerated rights and their enforceability by the courts has played out between those two justices, unstereotypically, if you will, in a number of cases. It may be fair to say that the founders of our Constitution, the framers of our Constitution, had a different understanding of the nature of rights and their foundation, grounded in Enlightenment natural law philosophy, than we have today. Does that mean that the whole enterprise of finding unenumerated rights is no longer a legitimate thing for courts to be engaged in? Or is it still possible to do so and tie into that original understanding of what qualified, what was the foundation for unenumerated rights? Or should we limit ourselves to merely positive law rights as expressed clearly in the text of the Constitution and leave everything else to legislative judgment?
John, I disagree with the premise of that question. I'm not sure what you mean by an unenumerated right. The rights that are often referred to as unenumerated are based on interpreting the word liberty in the Due Process Clauses of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment. So the long list of rights that I mentioned that the Supreme Court has protected under liberty come from interpreting that. Freedom of association is an unenumerated right because association isn't mentioned in the First Amendment, but it's part of interpreting words like speech and assembly. We go on with examples. Personal jurisdiction, I guess, is an unenumerated right, the requirement for minimum contacts to bring somebody into court, but it's based on the Supreme Court interpreting the word liberty in the Constitution. All of what we're talking about is how the words in the Constitution should be interpreted, and I disagree that just because the word freedom of association isn't mentioned in the First Amendment, that somehow makes it less entitled to protection than, say, the word speech, which we have to interpret also.
John, I'm going to take a somewhat different take on this than Irwin just did on your question. I think at the founding, and even and especially up through the Reconstruction period, the people who wrote the Constitution and who also wrote the amendments to the Constitution, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, had a very robust view of background rights that were either retained by the people or considered privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. However, they also believed that these rights, all of them, robust that they may be and broad as they are, could be reasonably regulated in their exercise. They believed both of these things. And rather than engage in, and the reason why when we go back and look at historical records, we don't see all that much speculation about all the natures of what these rights might be, even though there is expressed textual reference to these rights, The reason is that the jurisprudence of the early years and also the jurisprudence immediately after the enactment of the 14th Amendment was one that focused on the justification for government power rather than the identification of individual rights. So at the federal level, there was a lot of emphasis placed on whether government was properly exercising one of its enumerated powers, and a lot of judicially created doctrine was used to evaluate that claim. And at the state level, the issue was whether a state was exercising, engaged in a proper exercise of its police power. And some rather specific, abstract, but still relatively specific views of what the appropriate exercise of the police power are were developed in order to answer that question. So if we look back to essentially 150 years of constitutional jurisprudence, we see a strong emphasis on theories of government justification, rather than a strong emphasis on theories of individual rights. But that's because the background individual rights do create a kind of default rule in favor of the individual, in favor of the association of individuals, and requiring a justification before that default rule can be interfered with. And that justification can be met, but you then need to ask on what grounds is it justified. And that's where I think our theorizing and doctrinal development used to lay. But ever since, I would say ever since the progressive era, when many folks, both on the left and on the right, argued for essentially an unlimited view of government power, of legislative power, based merely on democratic will, at that point, the only constraints that were then imposed upon this exercise of democratic will were some kind of identifiable fundamental right that could then be posed in opposition to that, rather than a more strict definition of what the appropriate powers of government are, even if exercised by what looks like a democratic majority amongst a handful of people who call themselves representatives.
Well, if I could just, this is Pam Carlin, if I could just add on one thing to what Randy just said, which I found really interesting, is it's very hard to translate some of what either the framers in 1789 or the reframers of the, you know, of the Reconstruction period would do onto the modern welfare state, because so much of what people are now arguing over in many of these different contexts is access to government benefits of various kinds, so that things like, you know, the Michigan law school case, Grutter, or the Seattle schools case, or even the right to marry litigation that's going on now, takes place in the context of a society in which the government provides huge numbers of benefits to people. And the argument about under what circumstances the courts will step in to order that those benefits be given to people that the political system doesn't want to give them to, or are going to be regulated in various ways, can't be answered by looking back really at what the framers would say necessarily, because that's asking an odd counterfactual hypothetical. It's like asking me, if I had a sister, what would she have for lunch today? I don't have a sister. So I first have to hypothesize the sister and then ask that. So asking, for example, what the Fourth Amendment should say or the Fifth Amendment should say about interrogation or search and seizures can't ask what did they think in 1789, because we didn't have organized police forces then. Asking about public education and what people's access to public education should be like today and what restrictions should be put on the government's decisions is very hard to do by asking what would people who had no concept of public education think.
Very good. Well, I think we're coming to the end of our discussion. Let me wrap this up by inviting each of our panelists to give a short 1 minute or so closing summation of their position or their thoughts on the conversation. Dean Chemerinsky.
As the conversation went on, we more and more were talking about, should we be originalists or non-originalists? Should we have the court protecting some rights and not other rights? When should it defer to the legislature and not? I think that's exactly the right conversation to have. I'm distressed that judicial activism is really a phrase used by conservatives just to attack the decisions they don't like. Ed might be right that it's possible to develop a principled way of using the phrase judicial activism, but it hasn't happened, and I doubt it will happen. You look at the Republican platforms from 2008, 2004, 2000, 1996, each of them condemned judicial activism. Listen to what the Republican senators will say at Elena Kagan's hearings. It'll be condemning judicial activism, but it's not used in any meaningful or principled way. They never reconcile the Supreme Court decisions striking down government actions that versus the ones that they like versus the ones they don't like. So I think what we should do is have the conversation we've started to have here, the substantive one, and get rid of the phrase judicial activism.
Professor Barnett?
Well, thank you again for inviting me. I think that, you know, Irwin hears hears conservatives using the phrase judicial activism, and surely they have in criticizing liberal decisions or decisions they think of as liberal. I, in recent years, have heard many, many more liberals or people on the left use the same phrase judicial activism to describe the Rehnquist Court and now the Roberts Court. I hear activism thrown around a lot from the left towards the conservatives on the court, and when they reach a decision, sometimes this is probably done kind of ironically or finger in the eye, but given the origins of the term judicial activism, really on the left, not on the right, it's not surprising that it would be recaptured if the court moves in a more conservative direction. So with that said, I agree with Irwin that we should avoid using it, using the term, unless we're prepared to define our terms on the spot, I would say. But I also think that this discussion illustrates something that supports a bit of what Ed was saying, and that is that Ed was trying to focus our attention on judicial activism because it goes specifically to the appropriateness of certain kinds of judicial conduct, not just what the Constitution means, but how courts should be dealing with what the Constitution means. And I do think that's both a virtue of talking about judicial restraint and activism as well as the problem with talking about it, because it ends up being kind of a blanket condemnation of a judicial practice that is not well defined and is usually a reference simply to interference with the democratic majoritarian branches, rather than the kind of nuanced discussion we really were beginning to get into, and that is exactly how should courts comport themselves? How should judges comport themselves? Should judges have very strong deference to the majoritarian branches, or should, in fact, they be more skeptical of claims of power made by the majority branches when the liberties and rights of individuals are at stake? That is the discussion we should be having. It is a discussion about judicial role, not merely about, or I shouldn't say merely, but not only about the meaning of the Constitution. It is a discussion that's been provoked by using the term judicial activism. I just tend to think at the end of the day, the term judicial activism as normally used doesn't really get us any closer to answering the question of what is the appropriate judicial role in policing abuses of the Constitution by any of the branches of government, be they the legislative or the executive or the states.
And Professor Carlin.
Well, I guess where we've come down to is courts should intervene when they're required to by the Constitution, and they shouldn't intervene when they're not required to, which is another way of saying that we really do have to discuss what the values are that require courts to intervene and what values they don't. I thought the most telling exchange in a way during this discussion that we had was when I asked Ed whether he thought that Terrence Involved was an activist decision or not. And he said, well, if you grant my premises, he meant my premises about what the Constitution requires, then it's activist, but if you don't, you don't. And I think that illustrates exactly what the problem with judicial activism as a term is, or judicial activism as a way of condemning decisions is you first have to decide which values are in the Constitution, in the words of the Constitution, in its structure, in its history, and in its principles. And once you decide that, then you have pretty good guidance on whether a court should step in or not. But until you develop that, until you determine what the Constitution means in some ways, it's very hard to argue about whether courts have overstepped their bounds by striking down a particular law or not.
And Mr. Whalen.
Very briefly, first, I agree with Randy that the term judicial activism has increasingly been used on both sides. And, you know, I think it's a good thing insofar as that encourages debate among the citizens over what the proper judicial role is. Second, I will, at the risk of repeating myself, state that, again, that judicial activism and judicial passivism are distinct categories of judicial error with distinct consequences for citizens and for a system of representative government. I think it's useful to use those terms, imperfect as they are, confusing as they might be, just as all other political terms are confusing. And third, I think when those terms are used, we ought to do what we've tried to do here, which is explore just what a person means or why a person believes that a decision is wrong. I think that's a useful discussion to have. I hope this discussion illustrates that. And I think that's then yet another advantage of the term judicial activism. It can be used not as a dead end, but as a launching pad for further discussion of the proper role of the courts.
Join me on thanking all of the members of the panel, Dean Erwin Chemerinsky from the University of California Irvine School of Law, Professor Randy Barnett from the Georgetown University Law Center, Professor Pamela Carlin from the Stanford Law School, and Mr. Edward Whalen from the Ethics and Public Policy Center. This is John Eastman, the chairman of the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group broadcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. And again, thank you all for joining us.